We really, really appreciate all the work that all the authors put into these white papers. They've been working on these papers since last December, and we just were really overwhelmed with how much work they put into them, and we did not pay them, so. So I'm just going to give a few more comments. So at the end of the conference, we had a third breakout session for people to just give general recommendations on eliminating health and safety disparities at work. And the recommendations they made, we didn't want them all to be just for the government to do, so we asked them to do recommendations for different entities. So there are recommendations for state and local health departments, federal research agencies, enforcement agencies, local nonprofits, and as well as the people that came to the conference themselves, what they could do to work towards eliminating health and safety disparities at work. As you can see from the handout, there were many, many recommendations, and I just picked out a few of them. And these aren't because people voted these as the top ones. It was just some that I picked out. So. So as far as research, they recommended that occupation and industry should be included in research as a social determinant of health. Often work is left out, occupation is left out. We should also use research methods that capture the experience of the populations in which disparities occur, such as community-based participatory research. Sometimes there are small numbers of these people in the larger studies that don't get captured. The second was data collection analysis and utilization. Work should be included in data collections, even if they do not primarily address work. For example, electronic health records and health impact assessments. And one attendee said that there was a health impact assessment that was about a road project that included all the community surrounding the road project, but it didn't actually include the workers that were in the road project. So, and then also for electronic health records, there was also an Industry of Medicine report that was just released on studying this topic. So for policy development dissemination, a recommendation was to create national emphasis programs to target the underserved groups. And I think this was done in the past, but it's not really done right now. And then for services, occupational health should be a component of the HRSA-funded community health centers, where many of these low-income workers seek care. And with the new health program, they're receiving a lot of more funds, so they might be able to do this. For public education and training, peer health educators trained in occupational health and safety could be important in overcoming language and cultural barriers that exist in these populations. So for the second day of the conference in the afternoon, we were requested to allow the environmental justice working group, what is it called, the IJ? Interagency Working Group on Environmental Justice, which is all the departments at the federal government departments did environmental justice strategies, and HHS was the sponsor of the one that occurred at the Eliminating Health and Safety Disparities at Work conference. And although the final recommendations from the work group or for the environmental justice strategy came out right after the conference, so they aren't included in the actual strategy. A lot of the things that were recommended in the breakout group are actually in the environmental justice strategy. So some of those include the ones that I've put on the paper, and especially the electronic health records, and also the training community health workers to in occupational safety and health topics. So the environmental justice strategy came out on October 4th, and they are soliciting input until December 3rd, 2011. And so we encourage you to go in and comment on the mentions of occupational safety and health that are in the strategy. So this is the conference website. It'll be up on the web at this site for the foreseeable future, but maybe move to another site later on. But you can go to this website and find all of the issue papers on the issue paper tab, so you can read the more in-depth version of the papers. And we'll also be working to disseminate what we learned from this process in many different ways, including curriculum, book, journal articles, everything we can think of. So we'll be working in the next year to try to disseminate everything that we learned. So now I'm going to ask the panel members to come up here. Do we have time? Okay, so we have about 20 minutes to take questions. Unfortunately, we only have one microphone, but we can make people stand up. I think we need one more chair. Do we have any questions for the panelists? If you could speak up.
Good morning. I wanted to congratulate all of you for the good work that you've done. I attended the Chicago conference. Very impressed and really kind of made it work well. I wanted to just give you a thought on this, and it's not directed to any particular whoever wants to answer it. For the past 6-7 years, we have worked in, I'm from Oregon, with indigenous farm workers to try to improve the level of training information about occupational health and safety and agriculture. And so the idea, so that they come forward and report violations, et cetera. The flip side of that is that I think that the agencies, for example, our local OSHA, may be ill-prepared to receive complaints in a way that they can act on quickly, efficiently, with the resources that they have. It's whether it's because of language mismatch or because of the enforcement approach that they might take. And so my question to you, as to those who look at the enforcement aspect and the other countries, what made the enforcement, what made it work is what I'm trying to figure out. And I wonder, for example, at least in our region, they are focused on increased number of on-site inspections, but not necessarily fines that I think would make a difference in complying. And I just wondered, when you look at that, whether it's international or national, what did you see as enforcement provisions that did have to be, did make a difference?
I think that's a great question. I mean, it gets to the point that I think Cassandra mentioned about excluded workers. Or no, it was Liz's paper. It was excluded workers. And, you know, basically farm workers have been an excluded class. I mean, in theory, there are certain OSHA standards that cover farm workers. But, you know, in my conversations with OSHA officials around the country, usually they basically don't believe that that they cover farm workers. Even at the conference in Chicago, where we had one of the best OSHA regional or area directors in the country there, that issue came up, and he said that they were starting to go out and do some inspections of farms for the first time ever. And this is in rural Illinois, where, you know, there's lots of farms and farm workers, and there are some OSHA standards that cover farm workers, but it's clear to me that OSHA basically doesn't, for the most part, doesn't see farm workers as in their jurisdiction. And so I don't really have a good answer to your question, other than that it just is going to take a lot of advocacy to raise the profile of the hazards of farm work and to try to overcome the barrier that was set up when the OSHA Act was initially established, which mostly excluded farm workers. I don't know, Mary might have some comments on that.
Well, I'm from Washington State, and my name is Mary Miller. And, you know, I've seen it really vary a lot in the state commitment and really by the individuals or the local policies. So legislation would actually be one of the recommendations that isn't on that list. For local level legislation, provide more emphasis. And because we, in Washington, we cover farm workers for workers' comp. They were automatically all the general duty industry standards, all the general industry standards were brought in and made an agriculture health and safety standard that was happened in the late 80s. So it was a commitment by advocates and various, you know, people in the public sector that made that happen, and I know we're quite unique. So, but it would happen on a local level. And I will say at OSHA, having been there on a sabbatical for 8 months recently, that there's a general belief there, and I repeated it. I mean, I kept trying to just, you know, myth bust. There's really a general belief that people don't think that the OSHA Act covers agriculture workers because of the 10, you know, 10 or less. 60% of farm workers are covered by the OSHA Act because they work on the 10% of farms that are big enough to cover them. So, but, you know, there is this problem about the smaller. Again, over and over, people said the rider shouldn't prevent interventions like education and outreach and consultation. And that hadn't even been figured out for sure. But anyway, there is a myth, I think, that has been perpetuated that I think people really need to address. But I think the local legislation is really kind of, in my opinion, the way that's going to make the changes and
I have two questions. It seems to me there's a difference between looking at structural injustice and the socio-ecological model that puts the individual at the core, and it may tend to look at individual people. So one question is, how are you going to resolve these two very different approaches in this report and make sure things really happen in a big way? And then my second question is, it's so big and it's so comprehensive, how are we going to be able to use this report to really get people to do things, to make things better?
They're putting you on the
committee.
Eduardo wants to
answer. I can answer the second part. Well, I mean, I do think, and then I'll let. I mean, I do think that part of it is this idea of bringing the issues of occupational safety and health into the social determinants of health model. And, I mean, it seems obvious to all of us, but I don't think it's obvious to a lot of the other people at this conference. And they sort of know that work is important, but if you can really sort of very specifically name things like discrimination and you know, other sorts of issues, I think part of it is beginning to have greater collaborations with people outside of occupational health. And so so in that sense, I think having a report that puts it all together and, you know, one of the things we've thought about is curriculum that could go into social determinants of health or environmental justice courses. Because once, I mean, I think we've all had the experience of once you talk to people about what we do, they say, oh, yeah, I never thought about that. That's really interesting, and it stimulates a discussion. So I think your point is you know, it's a huge issue, but part of it was beginning to provide information, research, and put it in a format that would be accessible to others to increase collaboration outside of our community. Eduardo?
The second point is actually easy. It's in our papers, we list people are doing many of the different issues to change the nature of the thing. Paper 5 that I'm very familiar with, we actually view the literature of efforts at the state and local level, such as community benefit agreements, living wage laws. So if people want a menu where to focus their energy, the menu is there. They're going to have to choose what they want to take from the menu. But the menu is very clear. It's not a general menu at all. Many of the papers we went to, policy level, the different levels of recommendations for you to choose in which level you believe you can be at. But it is there, you know, the review of most of the papers are comprehensive enough to show what people are actually doing. It's not really theoretical. So I think that second part is really there. The first part of the question, that's a different ball.
But it relates to something that occupational health can bring to the social determinants discourse, in that a lot of it is looking at risk factors, but we really want to move it to more talking about solutions, to focus on what are the solutions, and the solutions we have, are they creating disparities, what can we do about that? And occupational health has the right lens to be able to drive that discussion.
I was wondering, Sherry, you mentioned there have been some models for working partnerships between community health centers and occupational health resources. I was wondering if you could maybe just expand on those a little bit, maybe tell us more specifically what some of those models are.
Is Amy still back there? Okay, Amy, why don't you start and describe, since she was the source of some of our examples. So another case study that's talked about there is in Massachusetts, where they started out by doing, they were trying to use it as a surveillance mechanism to interview individuals who were in the waiting rooms of several of the primary care clinics in the Boston area, particularly in neighborhoods that had lots of immigrant populations. And so they collected information about how frequently people, whether or not people had been injured at work, if people were aware of the Occupational Safety and Health OSHA, that it exists, and if they knew what workers' compensation was. And I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but not surprisingly, very few people had heard about it, and many people had been injured at work. And so as a result of that, one of the community clinics they were working with, that experience got them to realize how important work is and that they needed to actually do a better job in collecting work-related factors. And so they on their own have started this experiment of including industry and occupation as part of their intake and finding better ways to integrate it into the treatment. So you could talk to Tish Davis, is the one who's been most involved in that.
It probably goes without saying, but I feel like saying the obvious, the economic underpinnings and the political underpinnings of what we're talking about, you know, we're facing the worst inequality in history since probably the early 1900s. 300,000 school teachers laid off. Public health departments being cut all over the country. People haven't had a raise in 30, 40 years. I just think that we have to, you know, connect what we're doing in public health with, you know, Occupy Wall Street and the other efforts at, economic and social justice. And any comments?
Well, I mean, I think I've actually been involved in the Occupy Cincinnati, and one of the things that people are doing as part of the Occupy is educationals. And so, you know, I would encourage people to, like, find their local Occupy and say, could I give a talk about, inequalities that come as a result of people's work and their work exposures. And, I mean, it's a great opportunity to do outreach and tell people about what we do and get them interested in it. It's a real teachable moment, and we should all take advantage of it.
I was wondering if there are any positive examples of countries like, remember the Unnatural Causes PBS series where they had the plant closing here and they contracted it with a plant closing in Sweden where the union and the government made the departing company, invest all this infrastructure in the local community. Are there we always sort of look to Sweden. I don't know if it's still Sweden anymore. But, if there are positive policy examples where job security has been saved or promoted or, effectively addressed through policy levels.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I wish I was more familiar with what was going on in Scandinavia now, but my understanding, yes, they are under a lot of pressure from the global economy, as many other countries are, and yet they still maintain certainly a much stronger social safety net than we have in this country, paid maternity leave and unemployment insurance and all those protections that are there that, at least according to the research, seem to buffer the health effects of the work stress that they're experiencing also. Even though those countries' systems are under attack, they're still maintaining, as far as I know, a better balance of protections. I don't know if anybody else has more specific knowledge from those countries, but at least the comparative research that they've been able to do in Europe comparing groups of countries and their social systems suggests there is, among other things, a health benefit from that. Yeah, I don't know if Rosie might have more to say about the MOU, but yeah, OSHA has made it clear that sort of thing's never going to happen again, at least under this administration. But just to be clear, I was not saying that we should ever discourage workers from taking action or contacting OSHA, but just to make people aware of the risks so that they can make an informed decision and encourage people, first of all, to work together collectively, not one person go and make a complaint on their own. Secondly, preferably work through a community-based organization that can represent them without exposing them to vulnerability. or a documented worker to make the complaint.
Yeah, I mean, so there's an MOU that's in place, and the commitment at the leadership level of OSHA is absolutely what Tom just said. The problem is, throughout the entire United States, including state plan states and USA, there are a total of 2,000 inspectors, so there's like almost nobody out there doing any inspections, really. And the problem is the, you know, whether in fact the message gets out to the guy who's out there, because somehow or another, he's got to let ICE know that they're not to touch this workplace because the inspection is going on. And the problem is in how it actually happens when, you know, that person goes out into that field investigation, and maybe that's the one thing he forgot to do. So there's always that risk, and you have to be always vigilant. So it totally depends on the advocates kind of maintaining awareness and maintaining this kind of protective effort because, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's in place, yes, everything should be fine, but you never know until you're the one who gets caught and it's happened. But that's why you guys are all here.
I believe people who study neoliberalism and now it's spreading all over the world have seen clearly patterns of where there were Shangri-Las. We used to call Northern European countries the Shangri-Las, where the social security systems work, a lot of social protection, social democratic kind of regimes. Those regimes have become less social democratic and more neoliberal. And if we look what's going on in Europe these days, in Spain, in France, in Italy, you can see day-to-day examples, evidence, in my opinion, of how these people are fighting the growth of inequality. That's one part of the deal. Fortunately, in other parts of the world, there is actually reduction of inequality instead of increasing inequality, especially in the countries of the south of the United States, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and probably in the near future, Peru, etc., Ecuador. Society is already in a stage of fighting neoliberalism where the market is not actually dominating what the state does. And by doing that, inequality has been reduced. Jobs have been created by the millions. Inequality in the countryside has decreased. Social programs that we consider to be relevant have been implemented by the millions. So on the one hand, in the northern Shangri-Las, they are getting a little bit worse. On the other hand, in the countries that we consider really unequal, inequality has been decreasing. So the evidence for those are not there yet. It's a very recent phenomenon, 5 years, 6 years. But the Gini coefficients are improving. The measurements of distribution of income are improving. So to me, this is solid evidence that in these countries, we will see reductions in disparities in the workplace because people who are in the informal sector are becoming formal workers with rights, etc. So not always bad. In places in the world where people are fighting bad, we are seeing improvements in environmental and occupational health disparities.
Well, sort of following up on that, but also Sherry's suggestion that we use the Occupy movement as an opportunity to do teach-ins. You know, I kind of wrote that down as something to do, and I thought I'd go back, and I know it's going to end up on that big, long to-do list. So I'm not just singling out Sherry, but if anybody in this room actually puts together kind of a basic talk around how to do that kind of a teach-in, and if we can all share it with all of us, I think then all of us would be much more likely to do it.
Yeah.
So
perhaps the National Class Network.